It is sure good to see everyone here today and for this opportunity we have to worship God together. I want you to turn with me to the book of Esther for just a few moments, if you will. We're going to be studying that book, kind of an overview of the book. And I'm going to take the title of my lesson this morning from Esther, the fourth chapter and the 14th verse, one of the most important verses in that book. We have here the instructions of Mordecai, the uncle of Esther, the queen. These were two Jews that were living in Persian captivity at this particular time. We'll get into that in a few moments. But there was a need for Esther to intercede on behalf of the Jewish people. And so Mordecai told her, if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? I want you to note that phrase, for who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? It's kind of an interesting phrase, especially when we talk about the certainty that individuals have with regard to God's work in the affairs of men in some denominational contexts, to where they know that God has done this for me, and they, I think, have a very skewed view of what providence is. And I want to talk a little bit about providence, but I think it's important for us to give a setting of this particular time. So the time in which we are referring was about 484 BC, somewhere around that time, 480 BC, the days of Ahasuerus, or Xerxes. You may know him as Xerxes. The individual we're talking about, it has been known by both those names. He is the king of Persia. And it was the third year of his reign in the city, which was the capital of the Persian Empire. That was Shushan or Susa, depending upon, again, where you find the reference to that. Now, at this particular time, Israel was not an independent nation. You may remember that the first king of Persia, after they had spent time in Babylonian captivity, granted the Jews the right to go back to the city of Jerusalem to rebuild the city and rebuild the temple. So he granted that liberty. The fact the books of Ezra and Nehemiah have reference to that period of time when they came back from Babylonian captivity, but it was a remnant that returned. Not everyone came back from that captivity. Many remained in captivity. They remained displaced from their homeland. And this particular book has reference to one of those groups. It was a community of Jews that lived directly in the capital city where Xerxes reigned in his palace, Susa or Shushan, excuse me. And so with those introductory thoughts in mind, might I very quickly give you a reminder of the story of Esther. First of all, we find at the beginning of the book that King Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, had a feast. And during that feast, he became drunk. And it does speak about his inebriation and the fact that on that occasion, he called for his queen. She was a beautiful woman. Her name was Vashti. And she refused to come to him during the feast. His desire was to parade him before all his nobles and all the people so they could see her beauty. So he was proud of her. I understand that as a husband being proud of his wife. But what he asked was something that I think was completely wrong for him to ask that. Inappropriate to ask her to come and parade herself before men. We talk about the beauty of women and that inner beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God, and how that women are not to seek to show themselves as objects of desire and individuals who would be immodest in their approach. In fact, one of the things about the text that Paul wrote to Timothy in 1 Timothy, when he talked about being sober-minded, being modest, being one who has a shamed face, that is, a bashfulness, is that this kind of a parading would be inappropriate. And so Queen Vashti was deposed as a result of her refusal to do what the king wanted her to do. And a new search was made for a new queen. They searched throughout the Persian Empire, and they came across a woman by the name of Esther. She was a Jewess. Now, they didn't recognize or know that she was a Jewess, but she was Jewish, and she was chosen. Now, at the same time, you may remember that there was a man by the name of Haman, who is the villain of the book of Esther, and he was promoted by the king and became enraged because at that promotion and at his position, that the Jew Mordecai, who was one of the preeminent Jews in that area, did not recognize him or pay homage to him as he thought that he should. So he became enraged by that. And as a result of his wounded pride, he determined to eradicate the Jews. And he prevailed upon Esther, he prevailed upon the king to basically sign a decree, and the Persian law, when it was signed into law, had to be kept even by the king himself. He could not eradicate that law, but that the Jews be destroyed. Well, Mordecai, who was the uncle again of Esther, prevailed upon her to make an appeal to the king to save the Jews. Well, again, he was not cognizant, or his awareness was not given to the fact that Esther was a Jewess, a Jewish woman. And as a result of that, Esther was a bit frightened because he had not called upon her, and to go and make such a request could cost her life. But Mordecai was the one who recognized that God's providence may have had a hand in Esther's ascension to the queenship of Persia so that she could intercede on behalf of saving the Jews. And of course, that's indeed what happened, because the king, King Xerxes, granted Esther's request, and through all the nefarious deeds of Haman, he ultimately was hanged on the very gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. We're told that Mordecai was promoted to second in command in the Medo-Persian Empire behind the king. So there's great power at that particular time that was given both to Esther the queen as well as her uncle Mordecai. Now, with that in mind, I want you to keep the question that we're going to have before us in the forefront of your mind. What kind of time was it that they were living in? And we've kind of alluded to some of those things by what we've talked about, but let's just quickly make 4 points about the times, the circumstances that they lived in at that time. And I want you, as you ask, consider this, to think about how similar it seems to our time. That's the key that I want to share with you. And so, when we point out the first thing is the wickedness of the king. Now, again, the king came through in the end, and I want you to understand that. But this time of drinking and revelry in the kingdom of Persia was something that was done to great excess. Now, we know wine bibbing and gluttony is something that is condemned by God, but these men were not concerned about the things of God at all at this particular time. There is a passage in Proverbs 29 and verse 2 that kind of alludes to that, not specifically that time, but the dangers that come in a place, in a culture as a result of it, and that is that when the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice, but when a wicked man rules, the people groan. And that has always been the case. And I want you to recognize that I recognize that politicians in our day and time are unpopular by their career choice. It's kind of like the same with lawyers. You hear that from time to time. But there is a reason for that. The pride and vanity that is almost required for one to campaign, for example. Look at what I've done. Look at what I can do. I'm the only person who can handle these jobs. And you see all of that kind of thing. But there are individuals who do not carry necessarily the characteristics of righteousness that God's people should hold. And that was certainly the case here. The time of drinking and revelry at this point was very large. In fact, it was that there was a period of rejoicing that Cyrus wanted the entire kingdom to engage in for a period of 180 days. He wanted to emphasize, show off his kingdom. And it finished with 7 more days of feasting in his palace. And there are various estimates from a couple of thousand up to 50,000 people that could be at this particular place and could be a part of this big week-long party full of drinking and revelry. Now I want you to notice in Esther chapter 1 and verse 7 of the text, they serve drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other, with royal wine in abundance, according to the generosity of the king. In accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory. So we are grateful for that. They didn't have to drink, but they certainly did. We are told the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. Do what you want to do. And Queen Vashti made a feast for the women as well in the royal palace, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. So that's what I do want you to understand first of all. We see it again in our society, the very same thing. The second point to be made with regard to this wickedness that existed was that appeal to immodesty. And again, it's one of the things when you look at the context of this, since there are not specific condemnations made about all of these things, simply it's stated as a matter of disagreement between the king and the queen, you wonder, okay, where was the king wrong? Where was he right? Where was the queen wrong? Where was she right? And we can look to biblical principles, scriptures in both the Old and New Testament, we see what God expects. So it wasn't appropriate for Ahasuerus to parade his queen in front of the people. Those expectations of Vashti were inappropriate. They were unfair to her. But then when she refused, she was deposed as queen. And the arguments that were made is, hey, if we let her get away with it, then all the women are going to be standing up against their husbands. Isn't that, again, something you see in our society today, where that correct view of the family relationship and the headship in the home is not something that is regarded or expected at any time? So I think there could be some fault to be had. That Vashti could have, I suppose, appealed to her husband and talked about her shame in so doing, and maybe some arrangements could have been made. I don't know how that would have worked out, but instead she refused. And we are told that what Ahasuerus, Xerxes, wanted to happen, Esther 1 and verse 11, was to show her beauty to the people and to the officials. When she refused to come to the king's command, or at the king's command brought by his eunuchs, the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. So there is absolutely nothing that is appropriate about that particular circumstance, but we do recognize how inappropriate it was for Vashti to be requested to come in such a way. Now the next thing that you'll note, because I think it is something relevant to what was just requested, is that women were not respected in that time. And marriage was not respected at that time. And one of the things I was looking at in going through this is whether or not Xerxes and Vashti got a divorce. I don't know that it's really said that they did. There's nowhere related in Scripture. But notice in Esther chapter 1 and verse 19, when the advisors to the king came and talked to him about Queen Vashti and her refusal to be paraded before the nation, it said, "If it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him. Let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes so that it will not be altered." Now that's again the way laws worked at that time. "That Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus." So we do know that she was deposed as queen. And she no longer had anything to do with Ahasuerus. Now, you know that through the Old Testament there was polygamous relationships. He may have just banned her to the dungeon or banned her to the harem, never to see him again, whatever the case may be. I really don't know that, but she was deposed as queen. And let the king give her a royal position to another who is better than she. So consider again Esther getting into the situation because of this. Vashti was deposed for the inability or unwillingness to to respect the king and his position. And now what Mordecai is going to ask her to do is to go and do something that was against, in effect, against the law and could put her at risk, put her at danger. The king didn't call for her. She was only supposed to appear before the king when he called for her. And he had not. And Mordecai was saying, go to him anyway. And it would depend upon his good pleasure as to whether he would receive her or not. And those that were not received could be put to death as a result of this. So that's the third point, or the fourth point that we want to give here. At the end of it, human life was very much devalued. All of this killing that was going on at the whims of the king, for example. But the most egregious example of this is Haman. Again, got angry because Mordecai didn't show him proper respect. And we're told in verses 8 and 10 of Esther chapter 3 that Haman went to Ahasuerus, the king. He said, there's a certain people that is scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom, and their laws are different from all other peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. Now, do note his deception here. Haman was saying this is a national problem rather than something that I have a problem with. I want to get rid of Mordecai and I want to kill all those who are Jews in the nation. So if it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasuries. So the king took his signet ring from his hand. He gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. Took the signet ring, gave it to Haman. In other words, put it in law, put my signet ring to it, and when that happens, it's unalterable. It has to happen. So that's just how quick they were to devalue human life, a willingness to basically have a holocaust before the holocaust to actually commit genocide against a people, an entire people. And so with that in mind, we do want you to keep in mind that it's a time much like today. Very much like today. I think that there is the devaluing of human life, although there is a constant call about valuing human life. We recognize that at the same time, it depends on what life it is. If it's an unborn child, it is devalued. If it is someone who is elderly and infirm, it is the fact that much of our society today are in favor of euthanasia. There are problems with these kinds of things. And what you see lately with regard to the riots that are going on in our nation and the protection of those violent rioters who have committed murder and killed individuals is something that shows how we have devalued life in our society as well. But there is a second point that I want to share with you that I think is important, and that is that it was a time where God's providence was at work in men's lives. And the reason I can say that is because of those words that were stated in Esther, the fourth chapter, in verse 14, that we read at the beginning. So let's read it again, because Mordecai had a good understanding of how the providence of God works in the lives of men. God's name is not specifically mentioned, but he knew, Mordecai knew, that God is the one that directed the affairs of men. Understand this, from the first day until now, God's providence has never been absent from the affairs of men. It's always been that way. There have been special times, miraculous times, times of prophecy, for example, where we could know God's divine will and we could see at certain times actual miraculous manifestations of God's power. And that hasn't been the case throughout the history of man. We're told in the days of the judges, for example, that every man did what was right in his own eyes. Now, he raised up judges from time to time and inspired them, but that was not the constant practice at that time. There were 400 years between the Old Covenant and the New Testament when there was silence and no man heard from God directly. That didn't mean that God was not active in the affairs of men. Then there was that period of time when Jesus was on the earth and his disciples established his law, that the miracles and the signs were again raised up by God to fortify and to establish the truthfulness of his will. And then at that time when that which is perfect, having reference to God's complete revelation, came into being, those things which were in part had passed away. Never have we ever been outside of this concept of providence. God has always directed the affairs of men and always assisted us. That's why prayer works. And so the days of Esther are very similar to our days in that regard. Now notice chapter 4 and verse 10. After Mordecai gave instructions to Esther to plead for the Jews before the king, Esther replied to Hachish, he was the one that was the go-between, and gave him a command from Mordecai. He said, all the king's servants and people of the king's providences know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king who has not been called, he has but one law, put all to death except, so there was an exception, so the king would not be violating his law, except for the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, that he may live. And I myself, she said, I haven't been called to go into the king for 30 days. And so what he was asking her to do is depend upon the grace of the king, the golden scepter being given to her for her not to die as a result of that. Well, Mordecai, in verse 13 of the text, after Esther's words were relayed to him, he told them to answer Esther, don't think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. If you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. You and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for a time as this. This is God's providence. The sovereign God of the universe has the ability to construct things so that the affairs of men are influenced by his will. Mordecai understood that as the chosen people of God, that God would not completely eradicate them. Perhaps he was aware of the fact that some had returned to the city of Jerusalem and were rebuilding the city and the walls and was grateful for those things. But he told Esther, it's going to happen. God's going to protect us, but it is possible that he's going to use you. That's the attitude that we ought to have towards providence. Whatever our needs might be, when we offer our petitions to God, if those things are in accord with his will, what he desires for us, those things will come to pass. Those prayers certainly are answered, whether it is no or whether it is yes, but we do not know how those things will be answered. The reason we don't is the same as he here. He knew something was going to happen. He just didn't know how it was going to happen. And so, as you pray to God and you ask for things to happen in your life, don't stop doing what you need to be doing to bring those things to pass, because God may be using you to accomplish these. That's the way God's providence works. We cannot, with any surety, that is, I've got some data or some evidence that proves beyond a shadow of a doubt to everyone who asks me that this is God working, because he's working behind the scenes. And so, if you look at this, because it's an interesting thing, this book does not directly reference God at this particular time, but you know as well as I do that God saved the Jews through Esther. And we find that salvation came, that saving of their physical lives came on that occasion, but it is not stated directly. But in Acts 17, as an example, we are told that God is the one who determines the boundaries of nations and the times of their habitation. He is in control in the affairs of men. Let me give you one other example, and then we'll draw our lesson to a close, and that is Abraham. You remember when Abraham offered up his son Isaac? Because God had directed him, so we have God's inspiration. But again, Abraham didn't know how this was going to happen. He just knew that God had promised him that Isaac would be the seed through which his great nation, the people of Israel, would come, and he had promised that to Abraham. And so we're told that Abraham, when he lifted up his eyes, he looked, and he said, behind him there was a ram caught in a thicket by its horns, and Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up, because he had been told to do so by God. He took the ram, offered it up for a burnt offering instead of his son. And you know what Abraham called the place? He called the place, "The Lord will provide." And I think that's a statement that we all need to share back and forth today. He states, the writer Moses, who who wrote Genesis, states that this occasion was noted in his time as an indication of God's provision. Notice this. It said, as it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord, it shall be provided. And we need to have that very, very same confidence. And so as we draw our lesson to a close, there's that final point that I want to make, and that is that the time that this was is a time where one person made a difference. And the lesson for us is the same. With God's help, with God's providence, if indeed it is His will, we can accomplish much good ourselves. And it doesn't take many of us. It can happen with one individual. Because regardless of when they appear in the history of man, the people of God have come in such a time as this, as it relates to their generation, and as it relates to the society of which they are a part. And that's why Jesus in Matthew 5 said, "You're the salt of the earth. If the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It's then good for nothing. You are the light of the world, a city that is set on a hill that cannot be hidden. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." And so that's the kind of time it is. The time of Esther is very much like our time today. And the importance of Esther is heeding God's will and trying to protect her people is the same that we are to do. Pray to God. Expect God's providence. Do what you can to accomplish God's will in the world today. And God is in control and these things will be accomplished. Now we're going to offer an invitation at this time. We hope and pray that you have no need to come forward. But if there is a need, we want you to know as your family, we love you. We'll do anything we can to help you, pray for you, baptize you if you've never become a child of God. Whatever it is that you need today, would you come while together we stand and while we sing the song selected.